Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome. My name is Gary Gentle. I'm the president of the Trade Publishing Group at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the proud sponsor of this panel discussion, and the even prouder publisher of Our Boston. Writers celebrate the city they love. Shortly, I'm going to turn the session over to Bob Oakes, who will moderate the discussion. But before I do, I want to speak briefly about how this book came to be. Like all of you in this room, I, along with my colleagues at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, was devastated by the events of April 15th. These events not only happened in our own backyard, but we had dozens of employees who were affected either directly or indirectly, fortunately no one seriously, by the bombing. The makeshift memorial was on our very doorstep, so the reminders of that horrible event were in evidence every day as we walked by the corner of Berkeley and Boylston. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt is deeply embedded in the cultural history of this city and region. We've been publishing books here since 1832, so we knew we had to do something to help support the recovery of the victims and the city itself. We just didn't know what. But within a matter of days, it became clear. When the literary agent and author Andrew Blauner, who's sitting right out here, and Andrew, why don't you stand up for a second so people know who you are. When Andrew approached us with his idea to publish an anthology of writers celebrating the city they love and to do it in such a way that all of us could give back to those in most need, we jumped on it immediately. Well, actually it was about 10 minutes, which was how long it took Bruce Nichols, the publisher, to find me and ask me if we were interested. We were. Publishing is always about passion, but this project was different. And from the outset, it was clear that for us, this one was personal. Every department, from editorial to design, marketing to publicity to sales, legal to social responsibility, and up through and including Linda Zecker, our CEO, all understood the importance of what we were doing. And everyone was fully committed to donating their time, their resources, and overhead to getting it done quickly and beautifully. I couldn't be more proud of the outcome. But what's really important to any publishing endeavor is what ends up between the covers. And if I can paraphrase the words of David Yulin from his review of Our Boston, which ran in the LA Times earlier this week, on what a book of this nature really means, quote, "This is a real-world example of how literature helps to cement or showcase community and illustrate the way a book can have a pragmatic impact on the world, whether stories are ephemeral or in some essential fashion practical as well. Our Boston offers one answer to the question, built around its premise that words matter, that they can be a restorative force," unquote. We at HMH are grateful that we could do our part, however small, to help restore this city. More importantly, though, we are humbled by the generosity of Andrew Blauner and the authors whose words appear in this book, four of whom are sitting with us today. We are able to give $5 to the One Fund for every book we sell, in part because they donated all their time and royalties. So buy multiple copies, tell your friends and neighbors. This is an important book for an important cause. And on behalf of all of us, I'd like to issue the One Fund a very large check. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce moderator Bob Oakes, no stranger to anyone here, and one whose melodious voice and steady presence as the longtime host of Morning Edition on WBUR has gotten me through many teeth-grinding commutes on the Mass Pike. Bob will in turn introduce our panel. Bob?
Bob Oakes couldn't be here today. So he asked me, Mike Napoli, to step in. You'll notice that I've shaved. We'd like to thank all the folks from the Boston Book Festival for having us back again. The Book Festival is such a wonderful event, and the organizers do such a great job. So a little applause for the Book Festival for all they're giving you this morning and will give you today. It's quite a pleasure to be here this morning with such a distinguished panel of writers and reporters, Mike Barnicle, Madeline Blaze, Lee Montville, Leslie Visser. Let's give them a round of applause, please. For all we've been through as part of this great city in this last year, it's wonderful, I hope you feel this way, that we can frankly be a little silly this morning as we cheer on one of Boston's treasures, the Red Sox, as they play toward what we hope will be the World Series starting this coming Wednesday night at Fenway Park. And if you think I jinxed it just now, you can blame me next week. We'll get to some serious questions in a few minutes, but you know, I'd really like to start right here where we are right now, bearded as we were a second ago. I'm guessing that there are thousands of people in Greater Boston and Red Sox Nation who over the past couple of weeks have been wearing these silly, itchy beards, believing somehow it'll help. We're still coming off the marathon attack. It was only 6 months ago. So I want to ask, first of all, what is it about this moment in time that has all of us loving this bearded notion at least a little bit? Mike, why don't you start?
Well, I'm not in love with the bearded notion. you know, I'm in love with the team itself. I'm in love with the fact that within 12 months, perhaps one of the most loathed sports teams ever assembled, not just baseball, but across multiple sports, football, basketball, hockey, are all great guys, so we'll leave hockey out of it, has been transformed into a truly likable ensemble cast. And it's a cast of you and me. In that, I mean, there's nobody out there, very few people out there, maybe a couple, who are huge superstars, megastars on the baseball horizon. There's a couple who are going to be, but it's you and me. It's ordinary guys making $5, $10 million a year, obviously, doing their jobs with a smile on their face, something that I think if you're lucky enough to have been able to do that in your life, you know what I mean.
Leslie.
I've had the privilege of being a native Bostonian, but I lived in New York for 20 years, and my husband and I now live in Florida. And what I've noticed, well, except for New York, where this was the worst experience I had living in New York City. I was walking down Park Avenue, and somebody came toward me with a T-shirt, and it said, 2004 World Champions, congratulations. And then on the back were all 26 Yankee titles. And I yelled, that's why we hate you. What I do know about the Red Sox, and particularly this team, is that if you're not a fan of somebody else, you are a fan of the Red Sox. And they have captured, I think, in Florida where we live, where just no one goes to Marlin games. You guys are so spoiled here. It is so discouraging to go to a major league park and you see a total of really 500 people. So it's a blessing to follow the Red Sox.
Madeline?
Well, not to contradict my crabby uncle Mike, but I think the beards look pretty good.
Lee?
Well, I have a confession. I was writing a thing for a website, Sports on Earth, at the game the other night when they were losing, and it looked like they were going to lose the first two games. And I, in my head, I was having a thing that they should have to shave all their beards because the beards were interfering with how they were playing. But then David Ortiz hit the home run, and the beards are just fine.
This is sort of a serious question. Do you think that this run toward the World Series for the Sox, which has cost a lot of people a lot of sleep around here in the last couple of weeks and probably drove our worker productivity right down, do you think it's our catharsis, the fall cleansing of our psychic health following the spring, the marathon spring of fear and tragedy?
No, I don't think so. I think that's putting a lot of weight, extra weight on this that I don't think is there. I think the big catharsis was when they won it in 2004, and it was the big crusade. It was never going to happen, and people had died and said their last wish was that the Red Sox would win the World Series. No, but I don't think it is the big catharsis.
Mike?
Nor do I. What I do think is that, again, once again, you go to a hospital, you have a blood test, and you come out O positive or O negative, and also you're a Red Sox fan, and the blood test, it's in us. It's in many of us in New England, and it's a truly an original concept in terms of a team. The Yankees have New Jersey and Connecticut, and they have a worldwide fan base, but this team, out of all 30 teams that play Major League Baseball, have such an enormous grip, a strangler's grip, on at least 5.5 states. You can go to Brattleboro, Vermont on a summer day and walk down a sidewalk and follow the radio coverage of a Red Sox game. You have now cable bringing the Red Sox all around the world. There are some newer Red Sox fans, obviously, as Lee just alluded to 2004, but it's just in the blood, not so much because of what happened on Marathon Day.
Leslie.
Yeah, I agree with both these guys. I think they were two monumental events that happened to us. And one, I don't think right at this moment is affecting the other, although we all wrote this book and you're all here because you care about both events. You care about the marathon and you care about the Red Sox. But I think it's this team is just captivating, and then we have all the history of the Red Sox behind it.
All right, and Madeline.
By the same token, though, I think anything that makes people feel more healthy and more whole and more oriented towards the future and towards building things, towards vision, not nightmare, in this town is good. And so I think there is at least a bit of a subtext that the team is offering people, whether it's overt or not, I don't know.
So I'm going to read some over the next few minutes out of the book. Things that these four people have written, and I'm going to hopefully get them to tell a few stories along the way. And Mike, I'm going to start with you. In Our Boston, you write about life along Dorchester Avenue, Dot Ave, just beautifully, I think. And I think you're at the heart of a little bit of what I'm trying to get at this morning in terms of what's driving us right now in the big picture of life. Here's part of what you read, part of what you write, excuse me. Here, meaning Dot Ave, we have a mini time capsule, a daily urban drama where many of the characters, the residents, the shopkeepers, the tavern owners, the store clerks, the priests, and the pupils may not wear the familiar faces from decades past, yet they behave similarly to those who were once here and have either died or moved on. They have friends, their favorite places to eat, to play, to take their children, to feel safe. They have their parish, their store, their coffee shop, and they think and hope and dream, sometimes actually believing it will last forever. And of course it doesn't. The vibrancy of life does. It defeats the small felonies and the larger outrages that afflict all of us at different moments in time. It means that each day begins with some promise and perhaps more potential, because a child will do well in class, a baby will be born, a marvelous voice will sing a song on a street corner, a young person will discover her own talent, a parent will beam with pride, the Red Sox will win a big game. An email from a relative in a distant land, the old country, will show up in the box of a smartphone, and it will come with a realization that here along Dorchester Avenue in the city of Boston, shattered by a bombing on Marathon Day, it is still more possible, more than anywhere on earth, to succeed or even thrive. It is that singular American dream that remains constant across the ages, especially to those who work so hard to get here. That's so good. What pushes us here, Mike, that will, that drive in the face of tragedy to succeed? And does it here in this city?
Well, you know, I am a believer still in the phrase American exceptionalism. And that slice of the city, Dorchester Avenue, that I wrote about, you can't Google it. You can't see it or hear it or feel it over a phone conversation. You can't tweet about it. You have to walk it and look it and feel it and see it. And when you do, you see storefronts and lawyers' offices with Vietnamese last names now on Dorchester Avenue. You see a Catholic parish and Monsignor Dan Finn, a priest for nearly 50 years, who, when he first came to St. Mark's Parish in Dorchester in the early 1980s, the parish was 100% Irish Catholic. And now it's nearly 90% Vietnamese. And you talk to the Vietnamese, and if you shut your eyes and pretend you don't hear the different style of language that they're talking to you in, you're talking to your grandparents and your great-grandparents and people who came to Dorchester or to this city or other cities in America 100 years ago. And they all came for the same reason. Despite what you see in your TV, despite what comes out of Washington, D.C., people who come here because we're free. And we're free to do anything we want to do. We're free to make fools of ourselves, as I used to do two or three times a week in the Globe. We're free to think. We're free to have a desire to work. We're free to go to school. And that, I think, separates us from all other countries. And that particular passage that Bob recited gets to who we are now in Boston. I am fortunate enough, depending on your perspective, to spend 3 or 4 days a week, each week, in New York City. And you can get on the subway in New York, which is the only way to get around Manhattan, and you'll hear multiple languages on the subway. And now, one of the great gifts that Boston has, I think, and hasn't really recognized in full, is you can go to different neighborhoods in this city and hear multiple languages spoken. And that's good for our kids, it's good for us, and it's certainly good for the city.
Madeline, your take on this.
I love what Michael just said. Actually, when I read Mike's piece, I thought it was absolutely exquisite, because I think he really caught what's happening here today, that those of us who have Irish Catholic ancestry are very proud of that, but it's taken a new form. And when you say that these new folks are like our grandparents or our great-grandparents, that I agree perfectly. It's just beautifully what it's beautiful what he wrote.
Well, I'm glad I wrote it, though. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
When I read it the first time, it was beautiful. It was beautiful when you read it, Bob. But I do think his point about Boston is a portal for greatness. Now, not everybody seizes it, but it is a portal here for greatness. I mean, and the effect now that the neighborhoods are melding. I always thought with Boston, unlike New York, which forces you together block by block by block, you know, the North End was distinct from Southie, which was distinct from Brookline, but it seems both finally... Did the Big Dig, did they ever get that done?
No.
But it does seem that now physically Boston is more together, and that forces different cultures.
Lee?
Yeah, we used to play basketball in the Boston Globe Basketball League, you know? It was great. The sports department would play against, you know, the pressmen and the guys on the loading docks and just get killed. But we played at the Dorchester House on Dorchester Avenue, and I always liked it that they answered the phone in the three languages, English, Spanish, and Vietnamese. And then these Irish guys would come in kicking soccer balls, and it was a true microcosm of what goes on in the city.
You failed to tell them that the best player was Jackie McMullen.
Jackie McMullen was the...
But I'll remind you.
Let me push back like a cynical reporter. Not that I am most days, but let me push back just a little bit. You think it's still true in Boston that it's still more than possible, more than anywhere else, to succeed or even thrive? Do you believe that's actually true? Or in Boston, in the hub of the universe, do we mix the Kool-Aid ourselves and then drink it? Madeline?
Well, I don't want to get too personal about my own personal story, but certainly I began here as a very young reporter coming from Western Massachusetts by way of schooling in New York. And for me, it was a place of enormous opportunity, and I think it's still that way for people. And I don't think that the city oversells itself. And anyway, when the bombings occurred, I was out of state, and someone found me where I was in this classroom I was teaching in and said, "You won't believe what happened." She was so concerned thinking about my feelings about this. And I said to her, "This doesn't make any sense." I said, "The marathon is a peaceable kingdom. Boston is a city that works. What are you talking about?" I was, in, like a lot of people, at first in complete shock, unable to decode what was happening. I think Boston has so much to be proud about. So much.
Lee?
It's so young. Boston is such a young city. I mean, there's how many colleges here? You know, I mean, there's embalming schools and flower arranging schools and all kinds of stuff. And the lure of the city is so great that these kids stay here and they start their careers here. And I think that's a great picture of Boston.
Leslie?
I think it's a risk-taking city. It always has been. It can't be that Harvard's the oldest school, that Boston Latin, that I know myself as the pioneer of my own career. Somebody had to take a chance on a woman covering the NFL for the first time, and the Boston Globe did it. Bill Russell, first black coach. I mean, it is a place that takes risks, and I don't think people here fear risk-taking.
And Mike?
Well, it appears that the city is certainly far less provincial than it was a relatively short span of time ago. 2 decades, a snap of the finger in terms of history. 2 decades ago, you can encounter many, many people downtown who would think Lake Quinsigamon in Worcester was the Pacific Ocean. So we are far less provincial than we were then. But I think that we take our eyes off the larger picture too often to pat ourselves on the back around here. And the larger picture, I think, could be mistaken, is the same here as it is in a lot of other large cities. It's in grade school classrooms. And if you go into a grade school classroom in Jamaica Plain, Charlestown, I don't care which section of the city you go into, public school, you'll see the face of the city 10, 15 years down the road. And unfortunately, the public schools in Boston, not all of them, but too many of them, are not up to the standard that we would like to see in this city. And as a result, getting to that goal that you spoke of is going to be just a little bit harder for kids coming out of school.
Okay. Before we leave here today, I'm going to ask, since we're looking ahead as well as looking back, I'm going to ask you all about the mayor's race. I just want to let you know that. Madeline Blaze, in the Boston Globe magazine, in an article on September 29th, there was an article titled Becoming Bostonian. It featured a few of the pieces in the book we're talking about today, Our Boston. In the opening paragraph, there's a line or a few sentences that read like this, and I'll read them for you now. And I apologize, I don't know who wrote this. I would give that person credit if I knew, but I don't. Boston tends to be a city you come to for school or for work or because you followed some boy or girl who, if you didn't, would surely break your heart. Yet once you're here, Boston has a way of getting under your skin. Maybe you graduate or lose that job, or get your heart broken after all, but something still keeps you tied here. Perhaps it's the friends, or the food, or the culture, or perhaps the sports, or the smarts. Who knows? For these few perfect weeks a year, it might even be the winter, the weather. It'll be winter soon. Whatever it is, live here long enough, and Boston will stop seeming provincial and reveal what it truly is, the perfect size for building a life. You can see yourself settling down here, getting a dog, maybe even starting a family. You can see a future. Madeline Blaze, you talked about growing up in Western Mass, and in Our Boston, you write about starting off your career as a reporter in Boston in the early 1970s. How did Boston get under your skin?
Mm-hmm. I think Leslie and I both have the Boston Globe to thank, and Tom Winship, the then editor, and in my case, Matt Storn was a city editor for starting me off. But I, when you're young, at a certain point, you're taking everything in. It's a kind of voracious intake, and everyone is new. No one reminds you of anyone else because it's all being encountered for the first time. And I found that the stories I was able to do for the Boston Globe, several of them, never left my consciousness for my entire career as a writer and a reporter and a professor. And I talk about them to this day. I'll be brief, but one was set in a ballpark, Fenway, one on a boat, a yacht in the Boston Harbor, and the third was outside the old Boston Garden on a windy, windswept ramp. And in each case, I went to the Boston Globe. I was the first woman to cover the first woman who was allowed to cover the Boston Globe. Imagine Lee was in the sports department that day at the Globe when they got the word that someone was going to be covering a game, and they wanted me to cover her covering the game. So I got to be, as I say, a footnote within a footnote, but never forgot that glory. Got to have the reporter, the players look at me and say, we don't like talking to sports writers, whether they're male or female. Very democratic. The yacht was a graduation party for Edsel Ford, who was the first male in the Ford Motor dynasty to graduate from college, Babson. His family rented a yacht off the Boston Harbor. They hired Jim Croce to sing for Edsel. 3 weeks later, Croce was dead in a plane crash. But I remember that as over the top as this party was, it was a graduation party. They were happy. Their kid, 5 years it took him, year of mono, I think it was $750,000 for the new gym, allegedly. He got out of school. Big party. And the third, my goodness, was these girls who were underage, who were hockey groupies, who in 1971-72 couldn't get enough of the Bruins. And they had these streetwise fan clubs with each girl saying that they were the head of the Derek Sanderson or Bobby Orr or whomever. And, of course, there was no internet or any way to prove that they were the heads of anything. But the bottom line is, at one point I said to one of them, you're skipping school, you don't look like you're eating properly, you're not even wearing a good winter coat. How has this obsession helped you? Did you ever even get to use it in school? And she paused, she said yes. Once my seventh grade composition teacher asked us to write about what we would most like to be, and I responded, hockey ice, because then the players would skate on top of me and think about me all the time. So I said to her, keep talking, kid, you're a $5 raise.
let me get you to tell a story by coming back to the Red Sox story. You write in the book, September 15th, 1972, a sunlit fall day, and the Sox are playing the Cleveland Indians that evening. The Globe's Cracker Jack sports section, which knew everything and everybody, had received a tip. A woman from a weekly newspaper called the National Observer was threatening to sue the Sox if the team didn't let her cover the game that night. No one was even thinking about allowing women into the locker room at that point. This was simply a matter of access to the field and the press box. Shouldn't the Globe be sending someone as well? Did the paper want to look like a loser in the feminist sweepstakes? I had been about to go home, but changed course when I got the order to head to Fenway. Before the game, the park on a perfect day looks like a dress that's yet to be worn. The clubhouse was filled with drinks on ice and featured free hot and cold running seafood. The male reporters barely gave us a glance, mouthing their cigars, tapping the ashes, hacking away on portable Olivetti's. Those are typewriters for those of you who don't remember. Worried only that their job might be jeopardized if the extent of its cushiness ever became public. My voice here, you girls, one said, are ruining our racket. What was it like that day?
Well, it was a day like today. You know, severe, clear, very beautiful fall day. It was before the postseason, but feelings were running high and happy. And I remember that the players, I think it was particularly Reggie Smith, being very gracious. I was told not to go near Yaz, and that he wore, the only thing I learned was that he wore his, if he'd won the previous game, he wore the same socks. And so we had lucky socks. And I, all my life, I've carried that around in my head as a sort of a charm, and I do believe in lucky socks. So, I think that I was actually, it wasn't me, it was this other woman, Diane Shaw, who really deserves the credit for this event. But for me, it was just to be allowed to fold myself into a larger story, to be a girl, a kid, a young reporter, and to be treated actually very graciously by the male reporters and the team was an amazing event.
You write later on, and you got into this a little bit a moment ago, but I want to ask one quick question on this. You write, covering the Sox that one time, even as a stunt, ushered me into their history. I am at best a footnote to a footnote, but I can feel forever that I've been folded into a story larger than my own. How so?
Well, I can dine out on this story as I am at this very moment. This is to feel that you can be around these people who are greats and just in a small way be ushering their story into other venues is what journalism is all about, really. It's trying to get the stories to other people. So that was really it.
You also write that Boston reveres its past but is in love with its future. It's a launch pad for humans. This one episode, coupled with the others, I imagine you believe that launched you.
Yes, and did you get the pun in that? Boston reveres its past? That was on purpose. I look at the people here, I mean, all just on this panel, and then some of the college kids that are around here, the embalming school people, whatever. It just seems to me that Boston is storied, it's filled with history, we respect the history, but all along there's another counter-narrative, which is we're taking these young people and giving them a place, a future.
Lee Montville, you arrived on the scene in Boston in 1968 and covered sports for a couple of decades for the Boston Globe. That's a pretty short introduction.
Oh, that's it.
Nobody did it better.
Yeah.
Why is it, do you think, that here in the city we revere our literary heroes, such as yourselves, and we reveal our sports heroes too?
I don't know. I was once part of a thing at the Globe in 1975 for the World Series. They wanted to put out a special section, and they were going to have different literary people from Boston contribute to this special section. And I went over it with Vince Doria, my boss, and he got George V. Higgins, the novelist, David Halberstam, Doris Kearns Goodwin, and a whole bunch of people. And I said, well, the guy you have to get is Stephen King. And he said, we could never get Stephen King. But I knew a guy from Bangor, Maine, who knew Stephen King, and he called up Stephen King, and he was glad to do it. And they had an unbelievable section, literary people look at Boston. And I think that the pathos with the Red Sox for all those years made them a great literary vehicle, you know, the 86 years and the running into the wall consecutive times just made it a great thing for literary people.
I want you to tell us all maybe a couple of inside stories here, at least one in this way. I imagine over the years you watched this town make or break a person or two in the world of sports. And we've been talking about successes up to this point, but I'm counting on you to bail me out here because I don't know how you're going to answer this. But in that great repertoire of stories that you had have rattling around in your brain, a story about a sports figure that this town broke.
Oh, I don't know.
Bill Buckner.
Bill Buckner, yeah. Bill Buckner, That was an amazing game. Leslie and I were both. Were you at that too?
Yes, I was.
And we
they were also all at Woodstock.
We were. we were here when the Mayflower came in at Plymouth. we were at that game, and you had to write early, and you had to get it done, and it looked like the Red Sox were going to finally win the World Series. And so I was writing a column in the bowels of Shea Stadium in this little concrete room on this little telebubble screen. It was like a little TV thing like this. And I was pounding out this thing about church bells ringing across New England and people celebrating and dead people. And Over in the corner, there was a black and white television with a bad vertical hold. And the game was continuing as I was writing, because it was like the eighth inning. And all of a sudden, people were gathering around that television with the bad vertical hold. And they're going, ooh, whoa. And I was typing and typing. And finally, there was a, oh, my God. I kept that story in that telebubble for about 5 years after that. And then one day I just pushed and it disappeared into the thing. And Bill Buckner was the guy. And we brought him back into the fold here in the end, though, haven't we?
Leslie, did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I was going to say my assignment, because, you know, the Globe, we sent, 35 people, right, to the to New York for the Mets. And my assignment was I was going to do the clubhouse celebration. Like, that was my sidebar. And all I remember is everybody was going downstairs. You were already down there, Lee. And someone said, hold the elevator. Mitchell singled. And then, remember, it all just fell down, Ray Knight. And it was just like, you know, your whole life. And personally, I felt, as we all did, didn't we all feel delivered in 2004, because I had been there in person for Bucky Dent, in person for Buckner, in person for Boone off Wakefield, when after that, I didn't even believe in dogs after Boone off Wakefield.
Ian Thompson had written a story. His assignment was to write a story. Vince Story, the boss, said, write a story. John McNamara is a genius, the manager.
Oh, God.
So he had written this whole story about John McNamara was a genius, and then all this stuff happened. And he said to Vince, Ian was very young, he said, what do I do now? And he says, write that John McNamara is an idiot. and so he said what he did was he went back to the story and he changed all the is to is not, you know? And John McNamara years later said, everybody was pretty good to me except for this one guy.
Well, he should have put Stapleton in it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want to ask, maybe I'm going to commit a sports sacrilege here. I shouldn't say that on the stage.
Okay, it's a Protestant church.
Thank you, Father. Among your many books is a 500-pager on Ted Williams. And I way underestimated, of course, when I say that Ted Williams had a lot of talent. But do you think he would have made it if it weren't for Boston and Fenway Park?
Yeah, I think he would have been a great player anywhere. Boston was a curious place. He was our first big superstar, and he just dwarfed everything. He was huge. And what I wonder about Ted Williams is if he could have survived today with the tweets and with the left field wall and the monster seats and people yelling down at him, because he played baseball in a rage, kind of. He heard the negative voices and said, well, I can go and I'll show you. And there are just so many negative voices around today. I don't know if he could have done it.
He was he could be a pretty abrasive guy.
Yeah, I mean, and he created situations. I mean, he had trouble with the press, and the press had trouble with him, and he created those situations. And I think he did it to stir himself up. He liked the activity, because as soon as he was done as a baseball player, he became like a really good guy.
although he still had a temper, even with a fly rod. I know that because the April before last, I was up fishing on the Miramichi River, where Ted Williams used to fish for Atlantic salmon, and it was second open weekend of the season. And the first weekend, it was warm in April, even up there, and people were fishing in their shirt sleeves. The weekend, I went up with my fishing buddy, a Boston University journalism professor. It was freezing. It was blowing snow out on the river, and we were so cold that the guides, and you have to have a guide there by law, actually ran back to the house and got a snowmobile suit for me that he bought for his wife at a yard sale for $10. He said, I think it'll fit you. Anyway, we came off the river early because we were still cold, and I said to my friend, you know something? I think that the guy used to tie flies for Ted Williams up here is still working and still has a shop. Let's go see if we can find him. Well, we had his name, but we had no idea where he was, and it was fate because we drove right to his shop. Turns out he's only in the shop for about an hour a day, and he was there behind the counter when we drove up. So we got to talking with him, and he told us a story, and this is where the Williams temper comes into it. He had a very nice relationship with Ted most of the time, but they both thought they were the best fly casters in the world. So Teddy finally said to him, well, prove it. So they went outside and they stripped 90 feet of line off a fly reel, which is, if you fly fish, you know that's it's an awful lot of line to cast. And Teddy goes first, and they set up a target 90 feet away that's only a couple of feet big. And they set up a target, and they're casting toward it. And Teddy misses it, and he misses it, and he misses it, and he misses it. And he gets it on the fifth one. And he looks at George, and he says, beat that. Beat that. They have nothing at stake other than ego. And George strips his line off, takes one cast and misses it. On the second cast, hits it. And he looks at Teddy, and he says, well, who's the best? And Ted Williams took his fly rod over his head, threw it into the woods, and never came back to get it. George took it in his shop and gave it to him like a year later, but he never came back for that fly rod. It was such a funny story. It was such an honor to meet the guy who used to tie flies, and they remain friends. But anyway, I bring this up because in the book, Lee, you write about another somewhat abrasive sports personality, Celtics great Bill Russell, who is soon to get his statue unveiled in Boston on City Hall Plaza on November 1st, and who, of course, was unfortunately in the news this morning. I don't know if you all heard it, but he forgot a gun, a loaded .38 revolver in a bag as he went through the Seattle airport, so he was detained briefly. Rather than have you read it, tell us a story about how you were sort of set up to ask Russell about whether he'd retire pretty much immediately after the Celtics Game 7 victory over the L.A. Lakers in the 1969 NBA Finals.
Yeah, I was 25 years old, and somehow a collection of circumstances sent me to cover the finals between the Celtics and the Lakers and in 1969. And there was a seventh game playoff, and the Lakers were supposed to win. They had Wilt Chamberlain and Jerry West and all these people, and the Celtics beat them. And so everybody's celebrating in the Celtics locker room. I'm all a flutter. And Will McDonough, who worked at the Globe, said to me, "Wait till everybody's gone and ask Russell if he's going to retire." A guy told me Russell is going to retire. And I said, a guy? And he said, a guy told me. And I said, why don't you ask him yourself? He said, well, Bill Russell hates me. And so I said, okay. So that's all in my head, and I'm getting stuff for other stories. And there's always a crowd around Russell, a crowd around me. And I go around, and finally, everybody's gone except for Bill Russell is standing there talking with one other person. And the other person is Jim Brown, the football player from the Cleveland Browns, who's possibly the greatest football player who ever played. So it's the greatest basketball player who possibly ever played in the greatest football. And I came up 25 years old with red hair and freckles. And it was a time that they were both big in civil rights and the whole thing and outspoken guys. And so I came up and I said, Bill, is there a chance you're going to retire?
And Jim Brown
looked at me and he said, retire? The man just won the world championship. And Bill Russell said, well, yeah, you know, I have a contract for another year. And so I kind of skunked away, and the story wasn't written. And, of course, about 3 months later, he did retire.
And so, he sold the story.
And he sold the story to Sports Illustrated.
Do you think Russell had a little bit, maybe that's putting it mild, but he had a little bit of a rocky relationship with the city of Boston back then over the issue of race. I think he called it the flea market of racism at one point. Do you think with the prism of time to look through, he feels quite differently about Boston today?
Oh, I think he does. I mean, because you're having the statue, and yeah, I think he does feel quite differently. It was just a tough time, and I'm sure there were a lot of things, and he was an activist kind of guy, and I'm sure there were different things that upset him. But he was a tough guy. He owned a nightclub.
Slades.
Slades, and I talked with guys at the barbershop across the street, and they didn't like him too much, you know, that he was tough there. So he was a complicated man, but a great basketball player.
I remember once his then wife, as you know, in Seattle, he lives in Mercer Island, and he decided they were going to drive from Seattle to Boston, and they got 2 miles outside the city, and the car radio broke, and he said, forget it, and they rode in silence the whole way across America because Bill would not pull over and get the radio fixed.
Wow.
No wonder they got divorced.
Leslie Visser, I want you to, I'm going to use you to bring us closer to present, to the post-marathon attack present. You write in Our Boston, in the aftermath of the marathon bombings, seeing the soul-wrenching response to the devastation, Boston proved to be fourth quarter tough. What do you mean by that?
Everybody was one. One fund, one... everyone in this room, we were all one. And I had felt particularly, the Boston Globe had sent me to cover the marathon at least 10 or 12 times, and we were all so connected, as Madeline had said. That was supposed to be the world party. The world comes to Boston, we welcome everyone. And that was so wrenching. I had lived in New York during 9/11, so I really knew devastation, but this cut me deeper. And as I said in the book, my two favorite words in the English language always used to be, quoting Henry James, summer afternoon. But after the bombing, my two favorite words now, if anyone asks me, are first responder. And I think we were all first responders.
I want to read a little bit of what Kevin Cullen, Boston Globe columnist, wrote in Our Boston, because it speaks exactly to that, Leslie. Bomb, he yelled, and he and the men from Engine 7 and Tower Ladder 17 were soon running full clip up Exeter Street, right near the belly of the beast. They had only just begun running when they heard a second explosion. Jesus Christ, Tommy Hughes said to himself as he ran. Like Upton, he was a former Marine and could only imagine what lay around the corner on Boylston. Tommy Hughes was almost immediately faced with a Hobson's choice. Two children, one a boy, the other a girl. Sorry. You know, I don't know about you guys, but even 6 months later, this stuff still gets to me. It just completely gets to me. Two children, one a boy, the other a girl, both missing a leg, lay on the sidewalk, like fish out of water, wriggling helplessly. Hughes reached down and picked up the boy, who was closer to him, but his guilt was assuaged immediately because another firefighter picked up the girl. The little boy was as much in fear as he was in pain. Tommy Hughes hugged him as much as he carried him. "It's okay, buddy," Tommy Hughes whispered in his ear. "I got you. It's okay, pal." Do you still get moved by this stuff? I mean, clearly I do. Do you still get moved 6 months later by seeing the videos, reading or hearing these accounts?
Yes, I'm sure I could feel it when you were saying it. And I don't know if you saw USA Today did that wonderful story recently about one of the iconic pictures of the young woman with her leg or blonde hair. The glass had shattered her, and USA Today just did a cover story 6 months later how she's working out. She had been a swimmer at Tennessee, and she's working out to get back, and it's all, everyone in Boston is helping her do that, and I don't know, I think that's what we do. What about you, Mike?
Well, that engine house that Bob referred to in Kevin's piece is located right up the street. It's right up at the corner of Boylston and Hereford. There's another engine house on over by Fenway Park that is, I think, the second or third busiest engine house in the country, because it answers all the hospital calls and chemical spills. So they go out multiple times, 15, 18, 20 times a day. The interesting thing about it, when you talk about first responders and what they do, it's almost always, aren't we proud of what they did on Marathon Day? Or isn't it incredible what happened on September 11th when the New York City firefighters ran into the buildings that people were running out of? Well, we don't look at them every day. And when we do look at them on those occasions when they're not doing something heroic, it's always about, Jesus Christ, can you believe what the cops want for a pay raise? And look at those goddamn firefighters. I mean, it's not a bad job. I see them sitting on the bench when I drive to work, and they want a 6% raise. Over the last 2.5 weeks, you had members of Congress getting paid for doing shit, for doing nothing. And we never cover that. So, first responders are great when things like that happen. But they're great every day.
Right. Everyone calls 911, right? You get in trouble, everyone calls 911.
People call 911 because they don't get the right meal in the drive-thru window at McDonald's.
Right, yeah.
Audience questions. We've got a couple minutes for audience questions. Does anyone in the audience here? Right here, sir.
It's a Protestant church.
Oh, coming right around the side here. Thank you.
All of you in the Boston Globe. One very quick story. Phyllis and I had lived in a number of different cities, and Phyllis had a major stroke 6 years ago up in Vermont. And she was near death, and I decided that we needed to go back home, and we came back to Boston. So I just wanted to mention that, so even though it's an adapted town for her. I guess my one question, and it actually had to do a lot with the Marathon bombing and also the demise to a certain degree of the Boston Globe. I mean, one of the things that I think about, especially with you, Mike, you know, writing about the neighborhoods, and certainly what happened at the Marathon was horrific. But I also wonder why things like Dorchester and Roxbury neighborhoods going up in flames in regard to the level of street violence sort of gets ignored, because that's on some level horrific as well. Innocent babies getting killed on the streets, you know, in drive-by killings, and somehow that doesn't seem to nearly have the intensity and the ink. And yes, I know that the Marathon was very much, but it almost feels like we pay so much attention to that, but pay so little attention to what happens in the neighborhood. So I was wondering
Mike,
if any of you have...
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right, and it's not new, unfortunately. The small horrors of a very small war in a very small area of this city and other cities too often go uncovered. Part of it, I think, is we're inured to violence. Part of it is, unfortunately, and I don't mean to indict the news business of 2013, but part of it is, and I referred to this earlier, you can't Google those things. You have to go there, and you have to know people there, and you have to do it on a repetitive basis, because no matter these, you know, magical instruments that we have now, people walking blindly down the street, bumping into each other. Excuse me, I have a Starbucks on my cell phone. I have the right of way, things like that. You know, and tweeting and Googling and everything like that. There's no substitute for eye contact. None. None. And there's no substitute for the fact of what I think what we tried to do in the old Globe, and hopefully it'll be recreated under John Henry to some extent. But what we tried to do, I think, all of us who worked at the Globe, was to put a story in the paper with the word yesterday in it about a person, write about people. And again, you know, you can't Google those things. Everyone here, if you look to your left or your right, and you talk to the person on your left or your right, right now, today, even though you might be strangers, the person will have a story. Everyone has a story. But you don't get it sitting in a newsroom, having to force-fed an online edition at 1 p.m., at 3 p.m. Leave the building.
Well, do you know what it is? It's so true. Going around the country, I don't see, which all of us here were masters at, I don't see original reporting anymore. I see people, they sit in a press box, they'll go to a website, and it's exactly what you say. They don't go out and actually speak to someone. So I do think that was a hallmark of the Globe, is they insisted that you do the work.
It's because we're chasing dogs and cats up trees. we have time for one more question. This this fellow right back here, that's it. He was the hand I saw first. Thank you.
What do you think of John Henry buying the Globe, and do you think he will fire Dan Shaughnessy?
You think he'll what?
Fire Dan Shaughnessy. That's yours, Mike.
Yeah.
That's going to be his big moral decision, isn't it? You know?
Well, he's not going to fire Dan Shaughnessy. John is a little like Jeff Bezos, who bought the Washington Post. And I refer to the both of them, but specifically John Henry. He's a futurist. He has the ability, A, to succeed at things that he chooses to participate in. But in terms of the newspaper, I would tell you this. He bought it for all the right reasons. It's not a vanity buy. He doesn't want to be writing editorials, about what he likes and what he doesn't like. He doesn't want the editorial page to assert his view of life or candidates or whatever. I think he realizes and knows and will work toward a time within the next 5 years when the bulk of the product will be online. I mean, I go down the end of my driveway each day and pick up the paper. I get 5 papers delivered, pick them up every morning. I told them, I said, John, not a whole lot of people behind me picking up that paper. Look at the dwindling number of papers for sale in variety stores. So it's going online, and he is that kind of a guy with that kind of a money to take that next step. I think it's going to be a reinvigorated product, a better product, and I don't think Dan has much to worry about from John Henry. He's got things to worry about, but not from John Henry.
Okay, I have one more question, quick question for all of you, and then we have to leave because we have to be out of here pretty much on time. Tom Menino's leaving Boston City Hall after 20 years in office. You optimistic or not about the future of the city with Tom Menino gone? It's a huge, huge political change. What's the weigh-in on that?
I think it's fine. I think, I think you have to shake things up every now and then. I think he's been a terrific mayor, but I think it's okay to have new eyes looking at situations and turning them around.
Mike?
Oh, I'm incredibly optimistic. Change is good. The city has skewed a lot younger, as Lee pointed out a while ago. You could walk around the Back Bay, you see how much younger the city has gotten than it was 30, 40 years ago. It used to be dark, gray, unfriendly 30, 40 years ago. It's changed now. And there's going to be a new mayor. It's going to be a younger man with a younger view. No slight to Tom Menino, who I love, with a lot more energy. And a lot more electricity about him in terms of, I've got this new job, I want to do something, I want to try this, I want to try that. So it's going to be good.
I don't even live in the city, and I am an acknowledged John Conley. My husband went to Harvard, and his son was roommates with John Conley, and so I have followed him from afar, and that is my guy, and I do believe he will re-energize the city, which is not to take away anything from Menino. I hope we're going great to great.
I just ditto. Buy the book.
Last read, really quick, because I want to leave you with something. It's from Leslie. Leslie, these are your words. Like any big city, Boston has its challenges with education reform, job creation, and neighborhood safety. But to me, Boston has always been the ultimate woman. Great spirit, great body, great mind, great heart. It's a place that makes sense of the world through stories, not statistics. We know that words are our theater. Being born and bred in Boston, what I always carry are the words of Nora Ephron, the great writer and director.
that which does not kill you makes you funnier. So go out and have a good laugh today. Root for the Red Sox tonight. Mike Barnicle, Madeline Blaze, Lee Monfil, Leslie Visser, thank you very much, and thanks to the Boston Book Festival. These folks will be signing the book in a tent out there. Don't forget, part of the proceeds benefits One Fund Boston, so pick it up if you can, and thanks very much.